Thank you so much for coming out this morning and sharing with us in the setting of church and God's presence and whatnot. I found this week. I thought you might enjoy it. It says, two women came before King Solomon, dragging between them a young man in a three-piece suit. This young lawyer agreed to marry my daughter, said the first one. No, he agreed to marry my daughter, said the other. And so they haggled before the king until he called for their silence. Bring me my biggest sword, said Solomon, and I shall hew the young attorney in half, and each of you shall have a half. Sounds good to me, said the first woman. But the other woman said, oh, sire, do not spill innocent blood. Let the other woman's daughter marry him. The wise king did not hesitate one moment. The attorney must marry the first lady's daughter, he proclaims. But she was the one willing to have him cut in two. Indeed, said wise King Solomon, that proves that she is indeed the true mother-in-law. I liked it. I know, you know, whatever. Well, listen, on your way in this morning, you should have noticed that Josh and I think with the help of Scott put together a visual for us here on the platform of a would-be throne and a little bit of thing. We have a new banner over here of a crown, and we're beginning a new series starting today called How to Worship a King, and it will take us all the way up until Easter. I'm so excited about it. I've been waiting for months, actually. We talked about this probably late last summer, maybe into the fall, and just been doing a whole lot of foundational things, looking at things over the months, and I'm so excited about being able to share some of this stuff with you. My goal today is to share some foundational things, some things maybe you've heard before or thought of before, but my goal is to set some stuff in place so that the things that I and possibly some others are going to share in the weeks ahead will make more sense to us maybe than what we've thought about them in the past. A king, how to worship a king. Do you know, when you really stop and think about it, those of us who live here in the United States of America, we really have no idea what it's like to live under a king. Let me say that to us again. We have no idea what it's like to live underneath a king. In fact, if you know the beginnings of how this America got founded, it was actually predicated upon the utter rejection of such a type of rule. Did I say to you, we have no idea what it's like to live under a king? In fact, I was just reading this week. Many of you are familiar with the Declaration of Independence, but one of the things I've discovered is that usually all we're familiar with is the first few words of it. We don't read the rest of it. Somebody will quote the first few words thinking, well, that must be all there is. So let me remind you of what those words say. They wrote and said, when in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitled them, A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to this separation. And then the part we're all familiar with, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Among those are life, liberty, and a pursuit of happiness. Now, we're familiar with that, right? We're familiar with that. Here are parts you're probably less or not familiar with at all. Let me read them to you. But when a long train, this is as the declaration goes down as they're writing, it towards the end of the first segment, if you will, it says this. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations. I've got a high schooler student telling me what it says. Okay, pursuing invariable the same object evinces a design to reduce them under, this is why we don't read this stuff, because we don't understand the word. Under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies. And such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former system of government. The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and use whatever he said, that word, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. So what they're basically saying is because King George III, okay, has been such a brutal dictator, we are throwing off our allegiance to him and to his representatives in favor of doing our own thing. How's that? That's it. And then what the Declaration of Independence does is it makes a list, a literal list, of all the bad things as a king he had been putting upon them as a people. Then, at the very end of it, kind of the salutation, it says this: we, therefore, the representative of the United States of America in General Congress assembled, appealing to the supreme judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do in the name and by authority of the good people of these colonies solemnly publish and declare that these colonies are and ought to, that these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved. Now, I share that with you to say, not because I'm not supporting the fact that they did anything right or wrong or anything like that. But what I want you to understand is that somehow embedded in our DNA as a country is the absolute rejection of being ruled by a king. I just read it to you. We hear it even in our political world today. You hear evidence of it. Do you remember when our former president, President Obama, was doing things with his pen and his phone? Remember that? What people were saying was things like this: what gives him the right to do that? We didn't elect a king, we elected a president. You heard that, right? Now, with the new one we have in there, the folks on the other side are saying the same thing. There is this thing embedded in us. It's part of our national and cultural DNA here in the United States of America that we do not want to be ruled by a king. They call that self-rule. the ability to govern and rule ourselves. We should be able to say what we want, what we don't want, what we like, what we don't like. We should be the decider of that, not someone over us. Are you there? Now, the problem with that is, you'll see it in greater detail in a moment. The problem with that is, Jesus is a king.
No mortal king.
It's not mortal, that's right. Now, all right, here we go. What is a king? Let's just start right here at the beginning. A king is someone who has supreme authority over a people or over people, a nation, a tribe, or a country. It's just a simple definition of what a king is and to some extent what it is that he does. Someone who has supreme authority over people. Now, the history of kings, if you're a student of the Bible at all, you'll know that the history of kings starts quite close to the beginning of the Bible itself. In Genesis 14, we have the first mention of kings. In fact, one of the things if you go there and read about it, one of the things you'll discover is that all of the nations that were on earth at that moment in time, all of them were ruled over by a king, except the people who would become known as Israel. Everybody else out there, all the other nations on the earth, they all had a king as their supreme authority, the one who ruled over them, except for Israel. Israel did not have a king, or let me say it this way, they did not have a human supreme authority or leader. God chose to lead Israel through a variety of means. At one point, he led them through the father of them, Abraham. He led them through a man by the name of Moses. He led them through Joshua, various judges, priests, prophets, all the way from the beginning, towards the beginning of time, all the way up to 1052 B.C., God chose to lead them through various appointed leaders that God would speak to, and then those people would in turn look to tell the people group, the tribe, the nation, Israel, what it was that God was saying to them as a nation. But it all changed in 1052 B.C., I'd like to take you to that point in history right now, and I want to try to show you a couple of things that will help in just a minute when we get into the New Testament for some stuff to make more sense to us. So in 1 Samuel, here we go right here, chapter 8, verses 1 through 3, we find where this thing started to shift for Israel. It says, when Samuel was a prophet, when Samuel grew old, he appointed his sons as judges for Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second was Abijah. And they served at Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain and accepted bribes and perverted justice. Sounds like a king, right? Right? Sounds like the stuff that kings might do. So here we have Solomon that God had used to work with his people Israel, to speak to them, to give them direction, to give them vision, things like that. Samuel's growing old, and just the natural course of events would be to put his sons in charge, right? Right? But his sons were not men of integrity. They were not men like Samuel. And so when they find themselves in charge, things go south really quickly. Here we go. I'll read it to you. It says, so all the elders of Israel gathered together, and they came to Samuel at Ramah, and they said to him, "You are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, just like all the other nations have. We want a king to be our supreme authority and our supreme leader, just like all the other nations have." You with me so far? Remember, from the beginning of time all the way up, I mean, depending on, you know, your old earth, new earth, whatever, that stuff, for thousands of years, God had led his people by not using a king. Now we are at a point in history where the people now are demanding that God would give him a king so he can be just like all the other nations on planet Earth. Now, here is the sad part about this transaction that's taking place right here. But when they said, "Give us a king to lead us," this displeased Samuel, so he prayed to the Lord. And the Lord told him, "Listen to all that the people are saying to you. It is not you they have rejected, but they have rejected me as their king." Are you there? Samuel's taking this thing personally, and God's now coming to him and saying, "Listen, I know we haven't had a typical rule like other nations have done things. I have been the one leading and guiding and caring for them and giving them vision and so forth and so on. And today, when they ask for a king, like all the other nations have, what they're really doing underneath all that is that they're rejecting me." And he goes on to say, "As they have done from the day I brought them up out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are now doing to you. Now listen to them, but warn them solemnly and let them know what the king who will reign over them will do." Now, I don't know if I need to say this to you again, but I'm going to anyways. Israel had not known what it was like to be under the heavy hand of an earthly king. They had only known to this point in their history, they had only known what it was like to be led by God through various people that God raised up to direct them. Am I clear about that? I just need you to get that this morning. They're now coming and asking for the same type of leadership all the other nations, the rest of the nations on earth have. And God is now giving us what's really happening, that they are resenting, or they're I don't know about resenting, but they're trading in God as their leader for leaders like they see in other nations. And God says to warn them. Now, I want to read to you. I didn't put this up on the screen because it's a kind of a lengthy passage, and it just would have taken a ton of slides to do it. But please listen as I read to you what Samuel now tells the people of Israel. Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king. I want you to listen closely. He didn't say that. I said that. Listen. He said, "This is what the king who will reign over you will do. He will take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses, and they will run in front of his chariots. Some he will assign as to be commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and others to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and your vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He will take a tenth of your grain and of your vintage and give it to his officials and attendants. Your maidservants and your men servants and your maidservants and the best of your cattle and donkeys he will take for his own use. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves. When that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, and the Lord will not answer you in that day. Did you notice a common phrase as I read that to you? He will take. He will take. He will take. He will take for himself. He will use you. He will abuse you. He will take and have authority over you in such a way that he's looking to benefit his own kingdom and his own kingship. That's what it's going to be like. If you want that kind of leadership, if you want that kind of king, well, listen, the next slide I'm about to show you is really the saddest part of this story. It says, the Lord said to Samuel, listen to them and give them a king. After they heard, after Samuel warned them of what it was going to be like for them to be under the supreme authority of an earthly king, they still said, that's what we want. We want a king like all the other nations have. And God then says to Samuel, go ahead. Go ahead, give it to them. They can be led by a human authority, by an earthly king. Go ahead. Even though he's going to take from them, even though they understood the warnings that were given, go ahead. Here's one of the things I want to say to you this morning. An earthly king, most earthly kings have as their primary goal maintaining their own kingdom. And in order to do that, they have to take from you or us to provide for themselves. Boy, do you get it? Okay, all right. And so, like all the other nations on earth, Israel found itself under the leadership of the king. And now for the next 500 years, from 1052 to approximately 15, have I got that right? 500 years, 1552, Israel experienced what it was like to live under the authority of an earthly king. Their first one, does anybody know who their first one was? Saul. Saul was their first king. And if you go back and you read that story, you'll find out that Saul looked like a wise choice on the surface. He looked like he would be the right man to lead them as a king. He was built just right. He carried himself just right. He had all the prowessness and all the makings of what a king should be. There was only one problem. He didn't have a heart after God. And so, sure, it wasn't long. It wasn't long into this thing. A few years into this experiment of what it was meant, what it was like to be overseen by an earthly king, they found out this isn't working so good. This isn't working well. It not only wasn't working good for the people, it wasn't working good for God. Saul wasn't a good choice. It looked like it from the outside, but on the inside, he did not have a heart towards God. And many of you know this story. Saul was rejected as king. He was rejected as king because he started taking stuff that wasn't his. Remember, these kings that rule over you will take from you, right? Saul began to take stuff. He took stuff he was told not to take. The problem wasn't his ability to carry himself. His problem was he didn't know how to follow God. And so he started taking stuff that wasn't his. So God rejected him as king. Eventually the people rejected him as king. And God raised up another guy. Does anybody know who it is? David. Do you remember what it was said about David? He was a man after God's heart, right? The difference between Saul and David, well, there are a lot of differences, but one of the key primary differences was is that Saul didn't have a heart after God, but David did have a heart after God. David, I don't know if you know this or not, but David, by Israel's standards, David was the greatest king they ever knew in their history. The greatest king. King David was the greatest king. Do you know what made him so great? What made him so great was instead of taking from the people, as a king, he was looking for ways, how do I bless the people? How do I make life better for them? Instead of trying to, protect his own little kingdom, he was a man after God's own heart. And what made him a man after God's own heart is that he was interested in blessing the people instead of taking from the people. Hello? Are you seeing it? This wasn't God's choice. God wanted to be their leader. God wanted to be their king so that he could continue to bless them and see them, bless them with life and prosperity and goodness and faithfulness and all the things that God pours out. But David was the closest thing he could find on an earthly level of a human being who would be able to tend to his people in the same way he would. David was considered the greatest king, still to this day, to ever lead the nation of Israel. Do you know how John Eldridge, in a thing we've been watching next door as men, John Eldridge said last week, do you know how to judge the difference between a good king and a bad king? And he said this, the difference between a bad king and a good king is what it is like for the people underneath their authority. That is how you judge whether they are a great king or a lousy king, is what it is like for the people underneath their rule or underneath their authority. Now, as you study Israel's sacred history, one of the things that you're going to find out is for the most part, they dealt with far more bad kings than they did with good kings. There were far more ones that made life totally miserable for them than kings that made life good for them. There is something that I want to, as I start to shift gears now, I want to point out to you something that occurred in the very next book in the sequence of thing here. In 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 12 through 14, the Lord is beginning to speak. And as he speaks, he says this: the Lord declares to you that the Lord himself will establish a house for you when your days are over and you rest with your fathers. This is God speaking about David, King David. I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, who will come from your own body and will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for me, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he will be my son. Now, on the surface, David had several sons. But on the surface, it would seem like, it would seem like who's being referenced there is King Solomon, who would follow David after a brief, yucky moment with his other two sons. Now, in the Bible, there is this thing called first and secondary fulfillment of a prophetic word. And here's what I mean by that, is that sometimes when things were being spoken in the Old Testament, they were being spoken about something that was going to happen maybe within their lifetime or certainly within that same period of history. And as we look at this, at what God is saying to David, we could translate that to mean, or we could come to understand that to mean, that he's referencing King Solomon. Here's the only problem with that. being the only fulfillment of these words. When it says this, I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever, that's not true. Hello? And it also isn't true that God himself would be his father and he would be my son. Are you with me? So we get a hint here in these verses that while parts of it may be referencing the idea of Solomon building a temple for the Lord, which we'll get to in a week or so, what's really being referenced here is the prophetic seed is being planted of another king that's coming down the road where his throne and his kingdom will be established forever, and God himself will be his father, and he will be my son. Do you hear it? Okay. As you go through the rest of the Old Testament now, this thing gets expounded upon. I'm going to give you just a couple of them. In Jeremiah the prophet, he says, "The days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will raise up to David a righteous branch, a king who will reign wisely and do what is just and right in the land. In his days, Judah will be saved and Israel will live in safety. This is the name by which he will be called, the Lord our righteousness." Here's another one, Isaiah 9. You've heard this one before. 6 and 7. "For unto us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace, and of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this." There are so many, I didn't want to take the time to give to you all of the ways in which this, as I said, prophetic seed gets expounded upon in the Old Testament to kind of blow it up. One other one, you may remember in the book of Daniel, King Nebuchadnezzar had a vision. And he saw this tower, I didn't grab a picture for you of it, but he saw this tower of a man. And he couldn't figure out what in the world his dream was about. So he went to Daniel and he says, "You know, what's this thing all about? What's this vision, this dream that I'm seeing here? What's it speaking of?" And so Daniel began to interpret what he heard the Lord say to him, to King Nebuchadnezzar. And he gets down towards the bottom part of the statue. And as he was going from the head to the bottom, he's talking about various times in history and various kingdoms that would come and go. But as he gets towards the bottom, he says, "King Nebuchadnezzar, there is a kingdom that is coming, a kingdom that will crush all of the other kingdoms on earth. And of that kingdom, there will be no end." This prophetic reference to something that's out there, something that's coming, where a king will come and rule and reign, and it will never, never come to an end. Now, I'd like to fast forward for you. After just sharing these quick highlights with you from the Old Testament, I'd like to now segue to the New Testament. We're just about done. Just hang in there with me one more minute. A few months ago, as we were celebrating Christmas, these are some of the typical passages and verses that are read. An angel comes and makes an announcement to Mary. He said, "Do not be afraid, Mary. You have found favor with God. You will be with child and give birth to a son, and you are to give him the name Jesus. He will be great and will be called the Son of the Most High. The Lord God will give him the throne of his father David." Is that waking you up there at all? "He will give to him the throne of his father David, and he will reign over the house of Jacob forever, and his kingdom will never end." Sound familiar? I just read to you verses that were spoken thousands of years before that. And now this angel comes and starts bringing that subject up again. Starts speaking of this reign of the throne of David and a kingdom that will never end. So here baby Jesus is in utero, right? He's not even born yet. He's just being thought about in the belly of Mary. And an angel comes and says, listen, Mary, you are about to, something's going to happen with you. Something is going to happen with you that God has been setting up for a long time. He is about to do something through you that he has been wanting to do since he was rejected in 1052 BC. He's going to bring his kingship back to bear in the lives of people. A few months later, some say a couple years later, you may be familiar with this passage. There were some people that didn't live in the area of Israel at all. They lived, I read this day, it was about 1,200 miles to 1,500 miles away. They've been studying the heavens, and they realized that there was a star that somehow prophetically spoke of a significant happening. Those men who were studying that decided to make that journey when they saw the star in the sky, and they got to the area, to the place where they knew they were close, and they asked, they inquired, where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? King of the Jews. We saw a star in the east, and we've come to worship him. We know them as the wise men, right? Or the three kings. Here they are. They're coming from 1,200 miles away because they think of that such an enormous event is happening of a king being born in this place of the world that is going to end up being life-changing for the whole world. Are you there? Now, somebody could say they were delusional, right? These people were messed up. What were they smoking, right? But I'm telling you, when you read that story, you'll find out that Herod didn't think they were smoking something. That there was something to what they were saying. So here we are. We have this prophetic word to Mary that this child that she's carrying is going to be a king that will rule on the throne of David, that his kingdom will never end. We've got these people we really don't understand a whole lot about coming from thousands of miles to visit the site they believe that this king has now been born in. But it doesn't stop there. It doesn't stop there. If we go on, we find out that Jesus, as he goes about his earthly ministry, is referencing this kingdom repeatedly. He's talking about this other than earthly kingdom. And at one point in Matthew chapter 25, he's talking about the consummation or the drawing to a close of at least that chapter, that season of the kingdom. He says, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, he will sit on his throne in heavenly glory. And then he goes on to say that like a shepherd separates sheep from goats, that God will through this king begin to separate people one from another. And some he will say to go to his left and the others to his right. And here it says in the latter part of that verse, then the king will say to those on his right, come, you are blessed by my Father. Take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. We have angels talking about Jesus being born as a king. We have wise people coming to visit him as the newborn king. We have Jesus talking about his kingdom and eventually the consummation of that kingdom when he will sit and rule and reign. But it doesn't end there. You may remember that when Jesus came into Jerusalem for the final time, the people lined the streets and they began to call out things. They began to proclaim things over him. They said things like, here it is, I wrote it down. They said things like this, blessed is the king who comes in the name of the Lord, and blessed is the king of Israel. They began to prophetically declare who he really was. And it goes on, Matthew goes on to say, all this took place to fulfill yet another prophetic word in the Old Testament that was spoken through the prophet Zechariah. Say to the daughter of Zion, see your king comes to you, gentle and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. So when Jesus is coming into his hometown, if you will, into the place, the center, the centerpiece of God's people, as he's coming into that, they're hailing him as king. But the evidence of his kingship does not end there. There is this amazing display. It's done in a mocking way, but there's this amazing display that while he is being arrested and on trial, there is this thing happening where they're actually declaring him as king, but yet at the same time, it's the very thing they're finding him guilty of. It's just this weird thing going on. And at one point, he has this discussion with Pilate. You may remember it. And Pilate says to him, "Are you a king? Are you a king? Just tell me, are you a king?" And Jesus says this. Here's what he says. My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jews. But now my kingdom is from another place. Pilate says, "Then you are a king." Jesus answered, "You are right in saying I am a king. In fact, for this reason I was born, and for this I came into the world to testify to the truth." Are you there? We have this thing going on in this trial, where this idea of a king is kind of brought up again. You know, it had kind of been submerged. It had kind of been, after they had dealt with the bad earthly kings, they kind of got out of that form of government and went to something else. But it was always on God's heart to be the people's king. And as he's going through that arrest or trial, we tried to mimic it a little bit here. But you may remember when they were mocking him, it says they took a scarlet robe and they placed it around him, and they took a crown of thorns and they placed it on his head, and they took a staff and they put it in his hand. And, you know, they were mocking him in that way, saying, you know, this guy thinks he's king or somebody. You may remember when they put him up on the cross, they actually put a placard, an epitaph, over top of him that read, "King of the Jews." Now, they're all thinking they're doing it in fun. They're all thinking they're doing it in a mocking way. But what they were doing was prophetically, in a real life way, coronating him as a king, establishing the fact that he indeed was a king. Through all their verbiage, through all the acts that they did, they were setting him and his rule in place. I look at it this way. You and I, as citizens of the United States of America, are totally out of touch with what it's like to live under the rule of a king. We don't know what that's like. We have no idea what that feels like. But this morning, what I'm here to say to us is that we better figure out what that means. We better understand what that means to serve at the beckoning of a king, because our situation is one where we have one. We have a king who is seated on a throne, and not a king that came to take, but a king that has come to give. Not a king that has come to build his own kingdom. In case you didn't know it or not, God's quite secure with who he is. Like, he's got nothing to prove. He's got nothing to take from you, because all that you have is already his. He's not a king who's come to make life miserable for us. He's a king who's come to bring us life. He's a king that's come to bless us. But it still behooves us, all of us, to understand. So if that is true, then how is it that I'm supposed to relate with him? If he's a king and I'm a part of his kingdom, then what's that mean? How should I then live? Because trust me, it's foreign to us. It's totally foreign to us. You're looking at me like, I know what it's like to live under a king. No, we don't. We really don't. I hope we're going to discover parts of that as we unfold this in the weeks ahead. But this morning, I just wanted to make sure that we all know that Jesus is a friend of ours, right? Jesus is our brother. Jesus is our Savior. Jesus, you know, Jesus is a lot of things. He's a wonderful teacher. He's our healer. He's all those things. But folks, one of the things he is without a doubt is King. And if he's our King, then we best figure out how best to relate to him as our King, our supreme leader. You know, for a lot of people, myself included many times, I think we like the form of government called self-rule much better. Just like England didn't like being underneath King George, I think there's a lot of times you and I don't like being under King Jesus. You know how I know that? Because there's a lot of times I'd rather do it Jeff's way than his way. When we do that, whether we realize it or not, we're rejecting him for our own self-rule. In the same way, when Israel hit that moment in their history where they were saying, we want to be led like all the other people are led. We want to do it like everybody else does it. Hello? I want to be free. We want to be free thinking this anyways, free to make our own calls, our own choices. Well, listen, can I just leave you with this thought or this, I don't know, dilemma? If on one hand we say that Jesus is our King, but yet we do that in such a way that we only do what it is we want to do and feel comfortable with, doesn't that make us King instead? Hello? Like a king's the one who's supposed to call the shots, right? But if I'm calling the shots, doesn't that make me king? Just something to think about. Pray with me, please. Lord, it is abundantly clear that you are a King. Your word has left no doubt about that whatsoever. It was spoken of long before you came to earth. It was spoken prophetically about at your birth. You spoke about it throughout your travels. You left here as a king. You're now seated in heaven, the Bible tells us, at the right hand of the Father, on your throne, Lord. And I want to say for myself, thank you for being not just a good king, but the greatest king this world has ever known. You surpass David by light years. You came saying right on the front end that you weren't here to take, but you were here to give. You weren't here to curse, you were here to bless. You weren't here to make life miserable, you came to bring life in full measures. And indeed, you didn't call people around you to serve at your disposal. You instead grabbed the towel and basin and served us. The king on his knees serving us, washing our feet. The king, instead of declaring us guilty and in need of being blotted out, that king decided to lay down his life for us. Jesus, you're not just a good king, you're the greatest king ever. And because you're king, Lord, we need to know best how to worship you. There are ways that, as the king that you are, you would like to be honored. We sang earlier this morning, let our lives honor you. And yet when we're singing it, I don't even know if we understand what we're saying. Let my life be an honor to you, King of my life. So Lord, over these next number of weeks, will you help clear away the cobwebs in our spiritual journey here? Will you make some things a little clearer for us so that we can see best how it is we can lovingly relate to you as our King? Lead us, O King Eternal. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. Don't forget, there'll be